Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on the 18th floor overlooking beautiful downtown Chicago. Here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. The NFL season has kicked off, so we're going to tell you how the NFL teams got their names as well. And we're going to talk about some rock and roll pioneers all this morning. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also check us out on Twitter. Follow us at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is Monday morning. That means we've got the Monday morning movie reviews to do. We'll talk box office, but also... we're right in the middle of the Toronto Film Festival. Eric Childress, who reviews the movies with us every Monday, always goes to the film festivals and does exclusive live reports for us. And he's going to do that this morning as well. And he is live in Toronto. So let's first of all welcome Eric. Eric, welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Now you didn't see any of the new movies for this week, right?
No, I have not.
Okay. All right. So let's get Colin in here then. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm coming down with something, but I'm all right. I can do this.
Okay. All right. Well, what should we do first? Should Colin and I just review the new ones, and then we can cut Colin loose?
Yeah, do that.
Especially if you're feeling under the weather, Colin?
Yeah, sure. That sounds good.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's start with The Nun. Colin, tell everybody about The Nun.
All right. Well, this is another origin story for the Conjuring series, and this one takes place in 1952 at a convent in Romania, where at the beginning of the film, a nun takes her own life after being confronted and haunted by an evil spirit. And she's found by this local delivery man, gardener, who goes by the name of Frenchie, and he's played by Jonas Bloquet. And he ends up being a bit of a guide for a priest and a nun-to-be who are investigating this whole thing. And they're played by Damien Bashir and Taissa Farmiga. And they're investigating this thing at the request of the Vatican. And of course, over the next few days, they get lured into dark hallways and graveyards and churches, where an evil spirit who looks like a nun, haunts them and entraps them in a variety of ways. So this one's directed by Corin Hardy. And I've not seen really any of his other work. I think he made a movie called 71, that I liked, if I'm thinking of the same guy. I think we all really enjoyed the Conjuring movies very much, or at least Derek and I did. Were you neutral on them?
I like the first one. I'm neutral on the second one.
Okay. This has been a pretty good series of films, and the first Annabelle sucked, and then the second one was pretty good, if I remember correctly. This one just kind of, it neither sucks nor is it great. It kind of falls somewhere in the middle. There's atmospheric things that I like about it. Visually there's some good creepy imagery going on here, and I do like the kind of old fashioned haunted atmosphere of smoky graveyards, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with the book series Scary Stories, but some of the images in this movie reminds me of some of the illustrations in those books, which I kind of liked. There's one sequence that stuck out to me that I thought was pretty effective was a scene involving burial. But the rest of the movie just feels kind of flat and uninspired. I mean, as interesting and as kind of fun as some of these sort of old fashioned tropes are, the actual execution of the scenes themselves kind of feel a little stale and don't really bring anything new to the story, or it doesn't really bring any new life into this whole universe that they've created here for these films. It's just kind of, you know, your sort of average, you know, your typical characters who get to investigate this stuff. The Tessa Farmiga character, you know, she hasn't really taken her vows yet to be a nun. That's a point constantly brought up in the film. It would have been nice if there was some kind of character element there other than just a formality. I appreciate that the guy, the local delivery guy, I appreciate that they try to use him as comic relief, especially later in the film. But those moments pretty much fall flat and they're kind of uninspired. So I don't know. This is not a terrible film, but it's also not particularly memorable either. So I'd say pass on it.
I'm with you pretty much 100%, Colin, and the whole thing. I really like the look of the film. I think the production design is great, and the photography is really good. And you're right. I mean, it does have these really beautiful, creepy imagery. Images in it. There are, you know, your basic amount of jump scares, and I think, you know, a lot of these movies rely on that too much. And after a while, it gets kind of numbing. You know what I mean? Like after the 50th jump scare, you're like, all right. I mean, come on, let's stop.
Yeah, you see him coming.
Absolutely. I didn't really care about any of the characters very much. The burial sequence that you're talking about, I think, is the best thing in the movie. But I'm not recommending this one either. But I think the casting of are they just going to have the whole Formiga family in these movies? Is that the idea? So I don't know. But it made a ton of money over the weekend.
Yeah.
And Eric, you know, made $53 million.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's crazy, man. I didn't
Warner Brothers hit on a new formula, which is to release a big horror movie at the beginning of September.
Yeah.
They did it last year with It, and now it's this one. And now it's like, well, I guess every year now they're going
to
do that.
Yeah. And then people went out in droves to see this thing.
Yeah.
It was packed when I saw it. It was completely packed. People seem to enjoy it. But again, it's not terrible. It's just, You know what I mean? There's really nothing in terms of characters. There's nothing to latch on to. There are a couple of moments that are kind of creepy. The photography is really good. The set design, makeup and stuff like that. So technically this is good stuff. They do a really good job with it and they bring on the atmosphere, which is nice, but there's really should be a story and more than just jump scares to go along with what is basically just great atmosphere. So, all right, Colin, I agree with you 100% on that one.
All right.
Okay, guys, hang on. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Childress is live from the Toronto Film Festival. He's going to give us exclusive reviews of a bunch of movies that he's seen at the festival. Colin Suter is with us. When we come back, we got one more movie to review. Colin and I will review it, and then we'll cut Colin loose and then talk with Eric about the Toronto Film Festival and box office as well. That's all coming up right here after the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, high above downtown Chicago, Illinois, on a Monday morning. And that means Monday morning movie reviews are happening right now. And also, Eric Childress is live in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival, and he's going to give us exclusive rundowns of the movies that he's seen as part of that festival. We'll do box office as well. Monday means my dad will call in and tell a joke. That's coming up later on because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about how the NFL teams got their names and some rock and roll pioneers and more. As always, our phone number for talk and text is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, let's get back to it. Eric is hanging out for a couple of minutes here before we start talking about the films at Toronto. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Colin, tell us about Peppermint.
All right. Well, this is a revenge thriller starring Jennifer Garner as Riley North. Just remember that because her name is mentioned 1,000 times in this movie. And she's a woman who works at a bank, has a husband and a kid, and is trying to make ends meet. And 5 years ago, her husband got mixed up with, or a friend of her husband's got mixed up with a drug cartel, and by extension, her husband got mixed up with it too, a little bit. Long story short, they find him and they gun him down and their daughter, and they thought they got Riley too, but they didn't. And now it's 5 years later, and she has been off the grid this whole time. She's been traveling around the globe, learning about combat and fighting skills, and is now back for revenge on, you know, her husband and child's killers. And a detective and an FBI agent have been trying to track her down. They're played by Jeff Hefner and Annie Ilanza. And now they are a string of murders taking place in and around the Skid Row area, all related to this L.A. drug cartel. And they're convinced it's her, Jennifer Garner, that is, and they're right. It's her. So this is pretty much your standard revenge story. You know, you're taking every man or every woman and just, you know, sticking in this, this horrible situation. And then they come back 5 years later, they get revenge and start taking these guys down one by one who are responsible. There's really nothing to add to that. And, you know, nobody in this movie behaves like a human being. They pretty much behave, they pretty much exist to propel the plot forward and to get to the next action scene, which with the high body count. On the plus side, it is directed by Pierre Morel, who's the director of the first Taken and District B-13. So this guy knows his way around really fast and unmerciful action scenes that are, and when I say unmerciful, I mean in their violence. But they're very quick and fast-paced, which is how I like my action scenes. So I like the way this guy directs them. Unfortunately, there's just nothing special about this movie to really separate it. I mean, at least District B-13, at least you had the parkour and you had the crazy sort of plot anyway with the whole Paris being locked down thing. Taken, you got Liam Neeson as a strong, you know, action hero as they come nowadays. And you know, his style of throat punching is, of course, very memorable. And Jennifer Garner is, you know, obviously she's had experience in stuff like this before. And so she's very capable and she's got the charisma. But, you know, the script just doesn't let her do anything else except, you know, do kind of a John Wick imitation, which is not very interesting. And her, you know, there's not much in the way of context given by the screenwriter. There's times when we're just not quite sure at what point in time we are, how, you know, how many days have gone by, so, you know, and it's just kind of, you know, it's very choppy. It's a very choppy film. And, you know, the sort of, it's also a bit, you know, kind of tone deaf in a way that is, you know, it's kind of a racist movie.
Yeah,
too.
I wouldn't say kinda.
Yeah.
Definitely
not kinda. But it's like, really, we're still doing the Mexican drug cartel thing, and we're going to gun them down in a shop that sells piñata, or it's a factory that makes piñatas.
That was the moment right there, Colin, when she's like gunning down 20 Hispanics in a piñata factory. I'm like, are you serious?
It's funny because
before I saw the movie, I saw it on Saturday, and Peter Subskinski, you know, our friend Peter.
Yes.
He had seen it, and he said, he posted on it, you know, he posted on Facebook, he said, I don't want to say that Peppermint is racist, but Jennifer Garner kills 20 Hispanics in a pinata factory, and I thought he was joking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's Peter, you know Peter, you know his sense of humor.
Yes. Yes.
I thought he was joking. I was like, yeah, that's funny, and then the scene starts happening, and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah,
he's
right?
Serious.
But there are, I mean, the one kind of trope in it that I found kind of a nice throwback. I don't know if it's probably not intentional. It's just a dumb script, and it's a dumb trope too. But like, you know, using Skid Row as a location, you know, and actually saying it and seeing, you know, canisters filled with fire and these homeless people pushing shopping carts, prophesizing about the angel. I was like, you know, that's very kind of sort of a B grade, you know, sort of an 80s B grade movie trope, B movie trope, that I just kind of like chuckled at a little bit.
Right.
But But yeah, no, this is kind of a waste of Jennifer Garner. It's a stale storyline. It's a stale execution, and it's racist. So yeah,
Not good. I add to all of that, and the thing that I found really sort of amazing about this movie is that, like, the three guys who do the drive by, okay, and kill her family at the beginning of the movie when the three guys, you don't even get to see them get killed. You know what I mean?
True.
Like, those are the guys. Those are the guys that killed her family, and then it's for the rest of it. She's trying to track down the head of the drug cartel. I'm like, wait a minute! You did your job already. You got revenge against the guys who killed your family.
Since she was able to finger them, in the lineup when she probably didn't. I mean, I don't know how anybody could have actually remembered those faces from that far back and as dark as it was and chaotic as it was. But she apparently did. And we're supposed to go with that,
right?
It doesn't make any sense.
No, it makes no sense. And all the stuff at the end, I mean, it's horribly stereotypical, the Vatos and all that stuff. Like, really?
Yeah.
Come on, man. And also, one of the lessons learned in this movie is never trust a guy with a face tattoo. That's right. You always suspect a guy with a face tattoo. And on top of that, the dialogue between John Gallagher Jr. and John Ortiz, who play the two cops, is horrible. It's so stupid and cliched, and I can't stand this. And when a screenwriter who's making a cop movie or a movie, or a thriller or shoot 'em up movie, and they use the sentence, "If you do that, you're going to get dead." I hate that. It's just the stupid, and they do it like four. It's like four times in this movie. Yeah, you go to that. You're going to that neighborhood. You get dead. Like, what are you?
Yeah.
What is that supposed to be? And again, this guy does know how to direct action sequences. So they're fast and there's an impactful stuff to them. They're very violent. It's an extremely violent movie. The guy can cut and stage action well, but there's nothing else behind this movie. It is really, really bad.
So, and did I miss something? Like, it's called Peppermint because of the Girl Scout cookies that her kids are selling.
I think it's because of the ice cream cone. Because the daughter has a peppermint ice cream cone.
Okay, I missed that.
I will say this, Colin. I'd seen, obviously they showed a lot of TV commercials for this before it came out, and in one of the commercials is a scene that is not in the movie, and she's talking to her daughter and says that she's made up of love and heart and peppermint.
They
cut that out of the movie. It's the title of the movie, and they cut that scene out, explaining why it's the title of the movie. So now you're left to believe that it's because the kid had a peppermint ice cream cone the night she got killed.
I even missed that. I thought it was because she was selling Thin Mint cookies. I'm like, this could have been called Thin Mint? Really? Okay.
So, does she leave any, like, on, like, any of the bodies as her calling card, like peppermint patty wrappers?
No. She hangs the three guys from a Ferris wheel, though. The three guys that ice her kid, she hangs them from the Ferris wheel, which is where they were the night that they got killed. They were at a fair.
Okay.
So it's a terrible movie, Eric. It's a terrible movie. So if you see it, you might get dead.
Oh, good. Well, I'm not going.
Okay, good. All right. Next week, before we cut Colin loose, we've got The Predator, which I know, Eric, you've already seen. You've already seen.
I have.
A Simple Favor, which is this really interesting looking Paul Feig movie that I can't quite figure out from the trailers, but it looks really intriguing. And then what else is next week? There's another big one.
I think it's White Boy Rick comes out next week.
White Boy Rick. Yeah, White Boy Rick comes out next week. It's a new McConaughey movie based on the true story about a 15-year-old drug kingpin and FBI informant based on a true story. And then, Eric, you've seen a movie called Mandy.
I have, yes.
And we'll talk about that.
And I will be seeing it.
And you will be seeing it. So we've got those movies are coming up next week to see. So, Colin, get some rest, okay, buddy?
All right, thanks, man.
There you go. All right. So that's what we got next week. Some bigger movies are coming out, and we'll get to those as well. So that's coming up. Make sure you tune in for us next week for another set of Monday morning movie reviews. Now we're going to take a break. Eric, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Eric Childress is in Toronto. He's at the Toronto International Film Festival live, and he's going to come back and give us some exclusive reviews of movies that he's seen so far at that fest. He does this every year at Toronto, and he does all the other film festivals and covers them for us as well. So we'll get some thoughts on his movies from Toronto right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. Coming up at 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. At 6 o'clock is Steve Cochran with your morning drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in later on and tell the jokey time. We're going to talk about some classic rock and roll pioneers. And we're also going to let you know how the NFL teams got their names on this, the kickoff of the NFL season weekend. So our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And we are finished up the movie reviews. A couple of bad movies opened this week. The Nun isn't terrible, but it's not good. And Peppermint is terrible. So we got those done. And Eric is sticking around. Eric is live in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival, and we're going to get some exclusive reviews of movies that he's seen. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
All right. Now, how many years have you been going to the fest?
Since 2004.
Wow. So 14,
yeah,
14 years.
14 years, yeah.
Yeah, wow. All right. Well, cool. And now, how long have you been there?
Since Wednesday night.
Okay.
Wednesday night. So the festival started on Thursday, so I'm four days in right now.
And how many movies have you seen?
On the ground, I've seen 19 movies.
Oh, man. All right.
And I skipped one this morning due to, but up late last night just doing a midnight show.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Well, I'm going to catch up with that later in the week.
Okay.
We'll talk about that next week.
All right, cool. All right, well, and how long are you there? You're staying until when?
Through Thursday.
Through Thursday, okay.
Well, not all Thursday. I'll be here for a little bit on Thursday, then I'm coming home on Thursday.
Okay. All right. Well, wherever you want to start, we always love to hear your reviews, and some of these will be coming out soon. Most of them, actually, will be coming out soon, and some of them won't, but we want to hear which ones would you like to start with?
Well, I'd actually like to start with my top two, which I saw this very day, or last night, actually.
Okay.
Two extraordinary tales of heroism, and one of them has a release date. It's coming out in October, and you can expect it to be a monster Oscar player, and that's Damien Chazelle's First Man.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait. I saw,
yeah,
you know, I mean, Eric, I can't remember what movie we saw. Oh, when we saw Mission Impossible in IMAX,
mm-hmm.
they showed 10 minutes of First Man, and it was the in IMAX.
And they showed, like, I mean, I can't imagine they showed, like, the landing or anything.
Well, they showed the launch. They showed one of the launches.
They showed the launch.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's as they're walking in, and the fluorescent lights are swinging back and forth, and they get into the module and all stuff. That sequence, they showed. It's like it was an 8-minute sequence, and it was fantastic.
Wow. Yeah. And the thing about this one, I mean, you know, you, Colin, and I years ago got to see The Right Stuff in the park.
Yes.
Years ago, and that's a very seminal movie in my life. It's a very important movie personally to me, mm-hmm. but I also think it's also an all-timer. And I think now that we kind of have, I think, is kind of a definitive cinematic trilogy of the space program, with The Right Stuff, with this, and kind of concluding with Apollo 13 in a way. Mm-hmm. I think those three movies kind of show this incredible arc of what this period of, you know, American technological history really was, and pretty much covers all aspects of it, and a lot of that is covered here in First Man too. But what Chazelle does, I mean, obviously this is the story of Neil Armstrong and the first moon landing, and you know we've seen, you know, first of all, it's remarkable that this story has never been told before on screen, that we've never had a movie specifically about this thing. You know, I mean, it's been From the Earth to the Moon, the HBO miniseries and that, but we never had an actual film about this, and it would have been so easy to just do the rah-rah, to just do, you know, the blazing music, and, you know, we feel really great at the end of the movie and all that stuff, but there's a real unique, dry approach to this film that works in spades, because it's a very personal story about Neil Armstrong. The focus is very much on him and his family, and but you know, without at any point letting go of just how much effort, you know, is put into, you know, making one of these things happen. I mean, the movie covers pretty much, I think, like about a 6-7 year period leading up to the actual flight. And what this movie really focuses on is just precisely how dangerous these missions were. I mean, you know, we see that, you know, every time you see one of these rockets launch, we're in the right stuff, even Apollo 13, you know, the music is blaring. We're, you know, we can't believe we did it. It all, you know, there are issues here and there, but it seems to go beautifully in a way. It's like, hey, we finally did it. And here, they put you right inside those capsules and right inside that rocket when it's going. And it is just, it's clunky and noisy, and it just looks like hell.
Yeah, well, that sequence, the sequence that they showed us the date was like insane. I mean,
and there's so much of that in the movie. Because there are other flights. I mean, it takes you through, you know, a lot of the tragedies that happened during that period at NASA. I mean, I'm very well versed in this period, so you know, when certain things happen up, I'm just like, oh no, you know, watching this thing. And you know, it's a remarkable performance by Gosling. It's a really beautiful performance, you know, because if you know anything about Armstrong's family history, this movie opens with, you know, something really horrific. And, you know, I sort of compared it in a way to, we were talking about this after, because we actually saw the movie in IMAX.
All right, yeah, good. That's
cool. We saw it in the IMAX screen here at Toronto. And we were talking about, you know, the why, you know, how the movie kind of frames why Neil Armstrong went to the moon in a way. And I sort of framed it in a way compared with E.T., where Spielberg said about E.T. that, you know, the greatest tragedy in Elliot's life was his father divorcing his mother. And the only thing that could fill that hole in his life would be the most extraordinary thing that could ever happen to him, and that was an alien coming down. And that's kind of what you kind of feel with when Armstrong finally, you know, kind of just sits back and kind of, you know, takes stock of where he's at on the moon. And it's a really, you know, I mean, seriously, Nick, you're going to be crying, I think, by the end of this movie. It's a beautiful film. It's going to be up for a ton of Oscars. Chazelle is the man. He, you know, he didn't have to tell the story the way he did, but he found, I mean, they're just in the flight sequences alone, there are angles and things that we've never seen in, you know, movies or stock footage or anything like that. It's a remarkable accomplishment.
All right, great. Eric, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right. That was First Man, which opens in October, and it's Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong. And a great word of mouth. Obviously, the buzz has been good on this. No pun intended. And Eric just gave it a phenomenal review. So, all right, we got to take a break for the news. When we come back, more from the Toronto Film Festival after this on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We did the Monday morning movie reviews, and now we're getting a special live report from Eric Childress, who is at the Toronto Film Festival right now and has seen 19 movies while he's been there. He's going to see a bunch more too, and we'll get another report from him next week. But we're getting some great reports from him now, and he just reviewed Damien Chazelle's First Man, which is about Neil Armstrong, starring Ryan Gosling, and gave it a fantastic review. And let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, how's Claire Foy in it? Because she rules.
Terrific. I think that she could very, very easily get a nomination for the movie.
Good, because I love her.
Whether she goes lead or supporting, that could be debatable. But I think that she's got more than a few Oscar clips in the movie.
Yeah.
That I think she's going to get nominated.
She's going to have a good fall because she's got that Girl in the Spider's Web coming out too. So it's going to be
Bane earlier. So
yeah, good year for her. All right. Okay. Now, you said the other one that you saw last night was also pretty amazing. Did you want to talk about that one?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Another tale of heroism, and one that probably not as many people clearly know as much as the moon landing.
Right.
But it's a much more horrific tale, and it's called Hotel Mumbai.
Uh-huh.
And this is the true story of 10 years ago, 2008, I believe, where a group of terrorists, organized terrorists, basically laid waste to a number of tourist locations in Mumbai, India. They went to restaurants, cafes, and they weren't looking for money, hostages, anything. They just opened fire and laid waste to the place. And the movie, starts off with that stuff, but it leads them towards what comes to be known as Hotel Mumbai, this very posh, very swanky, beautiful hotel in the center of the city. A lot of rich people go there. They're catered to, everything. It's just a beautiful, gorgeous location. And the terrorists, a group of four terrorists get in there, and seriously, they just start shooting. And Dev Patel plays one of the workers at the hotel. Armie Hammer plays one of the guests of the hotel. Jason Isaacs plays a Russian guest of the hotel. And it's about this terrorist incident, but it's also about those who were how desperate they were to survive. We've seen how many terrorist movies, from Die Hard to Skyscraper. Mm-hmm. This is the real thing. This is not a movie where you're waiting for the good guy to escape his find the right moment and grab the gun from
right,
a terrorist.
Right.
It's not this kind of movie. This was real life, and we're talking like over 100 people killed.
Jeez.
At least the reports in the movie were killed during these attacks, and the movie does a remarkable job of introducing us to characters, making us remember a lot of characters, not just the famous names in the movie, but a lot of the supporting characters in the film, the workers, people who stayed behind at the hotel to do whatever they can to keep these people safe. And I'm telling you, there are moments in this movie that rival A Quiet Place, and how you just want to remain silent so the terrorists don't find these people. This is not some cheap exploitation thing like that No Escape movie with Owen Wilson
right,
2 years ago.
Right, oh God.
It's not that kind of movie. This is the real thing, trying to document this unbelievably horrific incident, and it's going to have a lot of people holding their breath, covering their eyes. It's a rough movie to watch because it is unsparingly violent in its depiction of the slaughter that goes on. But it had me from frame one to the very end. It wasn't even on my schedule. I couldn't fit into my schedule. They added a screening last night, and it just happened to fit. So I went to it, and I was floored by it.
Wow. Okay, that's Hotel Mumbai. And I'm looking at the director. It's his first feature.
Yeah. So. It's a remarkable debut from this guy. Anthony Maris?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it doesn't have a distributor yet. I can't imagine that's going to go for too long. I mean, it's not all easy from the market.
Yeah, sure.
At all.
Yeah.
But some studio is going to want to have their names attached to this one because it's a pretty incredible piece of work.
Okay. All right. So that's Hotel Mumbai. Keep your eyes peeled for that one. All right, Eric, where do you want to go next?
Well, let's go to a couple of the midnight films. Right. You mentioned The Predator earlier, and I won't talk too much about this because we're going to be reviewing it more next week.
Yeah.
But this is Shane Black's new version of The Predator, new follow up to the story. And what can I say? It's fun. It's a Shane Black movie.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what if you like that, whether it be Lethal Weapon or Long Kiss Goodnight or The Nice Guys. This is a Shane Black movie through and through. It is filled with a lot of humor. He is very much more in the terms of like the A-Team than like the original Predator, where it was all serious, it was all
right,
hands on deck and all
right,
business and whatnot.
Yeah.
This one, they're cracking jokes. your boy Thomas Jane and Keegan-Michael Key.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, seriously, you want a spin-off movie with those two guys. Thomas Jane Thomas Jane gets to do stuff in this movie that's cooler than anything he did in The Punisher.
Mm.
And he also plays a guy that has Tourette's.
Okay.
So, added fun.
And he's, I'm really looking forward to this movie because I happen to think Shane Black makes enormously entertaining movies. I'm one of the few people, I really loved what he did with Iron Man 3. I know I'm kind of alone on that, but I love...
Like, yeah, I'm not a fan of that one.
I just love the ballsy move that he did with the villain.
That was fun. That part was fun. That was the thing I liked about that movie.
Yeah.
The rest of it, not so much.
But I'm really looking forward to it, and I love the idea of some of the casting in this movie. I mean, I love the fact that Olivia Munn is in it, and Keegan-Michael Key. I mean, I'm just really looking forward
to it. Yeah, Jacob Tremblay in the movie. Sterling K. Brown having a lot of fun as the jerky government guy.
Yeah.
That wants to capture the predator.
Yeah,
he's having a blast. You can tell the entire cast is having a blast with this movie. You know, and it's just fun.
Yeah,
it just ultimately comes up as fun. There are a couple things that are some clunky in it, but I had fun.
Good,
you know, it kept me awake at midnight. And,
yeah. Well, I can't wait. I'm very excited to see it. So we'll see that. We'll review that again in full next Monday.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah, we'll get into it more next week.
What else did you get into then?
Well, there was a little midnight movie last week or last the other night that you and I texted about.
Yeah.
Briefly. And it's David Gordon Green's Halloween.
Yep.
Which I'm sure the entire world was skeptical of when they first heard of the project. Then the trailers came out, and all of a sudden, some of us, like you and I, were being turned around on this thing. Maybe this thing's going to work. Maybe they understand, you know, the history of Halloween and all this. I think it's pretty bad.
Yeah,
Nick.
I'm really disappointed. And some people I know are like really confused by the timeline here. But basically, this is a direct sequel to the first Halloween. So all of the other Halloweens don't exist in this world.
Correct.
And he's also not Laurie Strode's brother.
Right. They've actually, there's a snarky little line in the movie where they say that, you know, that's just something that some people made up to make a connection or something like
that. Right.
So there's a line, and there's a lot of lines like that. You know, I mean, first I will have to say that knowing you as a non-Danny McBride fan.
Yeah.
His voice is all over the humor in this movie. Because, you know, that's what you go to expect in a Halloween movie, is the humor.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of it in this movie. You know, I mean, it was interesting talking about Predator and Love Predator and Halloween back-to-back, because Shane Black knows how to insert humor and to insert, you know, kind of, you know, snarky references to, the, you know, the history of the series and, you know, the kind of the jokes that, you know, fans even make in the movie. Halloween, you know, it doesn't fit very well. And what I kept saying, the thing that struck me when I was walking home or walking back to the hotel from the movie the other night is that very thing that you mentioned, that they've thrown out all the other sequels.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, so you clearly think that the rest of these movies are not up to the par of John Carpenter's original.
Right.
Okay. So you have a responsibility now to be that direct sequel. You actually, I mean, because the thing I thought going into the movie, I'm like, okay, well, this could be Rocky Balboa.
Yeah.
It's not going to be Rocky, but you could theoretically throw out 2 to 5 and just watch Rocky and Rocky Balboa back to back and think that those are a perfectly good sequel to the original film.
Right.
Halloween doesn't live up to the mediocrity of the sequels.
Mm.
You know, and I'm talking the later sequels. You know, I think Halloween 2 is a better film.
Oh boy! Well, yeah. I mean, I, of all the sequels, the only one that I actively like is H2O. That's the only one of the sequels that I really, really, really like.
I can't even go with you there either. But one of our colleagues who also does agree with you too that he likes H2O better than this new one. Said that the angle of the Laurie survivor aspect in H2O is handled much better than it is here, because here they completely just rip off the Terminator 2 thing.
Right.
It just, you know, Lori was, you know, had a horrible traumatic incident. She then trained herself to become a warrior. She passed it down to her kids, who then grew up to resent her. That's the basic arc of that story, and it doesn't work. And there again, they load up on the body count in this movie. I was really curious to see what Green and McBride were going to do with the gore in this movie, and they amp it up to zombie-like levels.
Oh, man.
And that's Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, and there's one moment in the movie where I wrote down my notes. I'm like, this is Michael Myers, not Jason Voorhees.
Right.
Okay. And you'll know what moment I'm talking about there. There's another moment in the climax where I kind of checked out for good. I'm like, really? That's where you want to take this story?
Yeah.
And then there's another moment involving Judy Greer where it completely dawned on me, like, these guys don't even seem to understand who Michael Myers was and what works so well about Halloween, because David Gordon Green is out of his element here.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't know how to set up set pieces. He doesn't know how to pay them off. The ancillary characters who are just, you know, body count fodder are straight out of Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, are you doing a gag on an entire genre? Are you doing Scream here, guys? Or are you trying to do a direct sequel to one of the greatest horror movies of all time?
Yeah.
This is a failure, okay. I'm sorry to say.
All right, I'm really disappointed.
Don't lose the hype.
Yeah, okay. All right, Eric, hang on, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right, Eric Childress live from Toronto giving me some very disappointing news. We'll come back with more. He's got exclusive reviews of more movies. He's up in Toronto, and we'll do that right after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a joke a little bit later on. And, we got a lot of other stuff coming up, too. We're going to talk about some rock and roll pioneers. We're going to talk about, NFL season kicked off this weekend, so we're going to give you the stories behind where the NFL teams got their names. And also, we're going to talk about sounds that kids nowadays probably have never heard or would have no idea what they were if they heard them. Another topic to make us feel old. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Eric Childress is live from Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival. He goes every year. This is his 14th year going, and he's seen a bunch of movies. We got a negative review from Halloween, a fun review from The Predator, and two great reviews from Hotel Mumbai and First Man, the movie about Neil Armstrong with Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy. And we've got more to talk about. Eric is up in Toronto. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, you got to be as surprised as me that The Nun made $53.5 million over the weekend, right?
Yeah, I was thinking low 40s.
Yeah,
honestly, I was thinking like high 30s, low 40s. The thing they were saying 46 when I first saw the numbers on Friday, I'm like, okay, that just sounds about right. Then Saturday it was 50, and then today it was what, 53?
53.5. So, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And what did it cost? I mean,
nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I mean, it's not like Blumhouse level, but like the Annabelle and the Conjuring movies are usually in like the $30 to $40 million range.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it made like another $70 million overseas already. So I mean, this thing is practically in profit already.
There you go. All right. Well, we'll get to some box office stuff a little bit later on. All right. Toronto movies. Where do you want to go next?
Well, let's get a little political. Okay. There's a couple of political movies that I've seen. One of them that we'll be reviewing a little more fuller in a few weeks, and that's Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 11/9.
Right.
And this is a film that, you know, people, you know, Michael Moore fans at least, have been waiting for to see his, you know, this sort of definitive take on Donald Trump. And the thing that's actually, you know, the thing that's not surprising about the film is precisely how angry this movie is. I mean, I think in all of the movies that he's done, the level of anger displayed throughout this film, and I got to say, you know, maybe not evenly balanced, but he doesn't, you know, pull any punches. I mean, he goes after Republicans, Democrats, you know, everything in this movie. And in some ways, it plays in a way like a kind of like a retrospective of Michael Moore's entire filmography, because you'd actually be kind of surprised for a good portion of this movie, how little Trump is actually in it.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, this movie takes the wise approach of not trying to keep up with the Trump news, as far as, you know, like you know, charting all of the missteps that's been made over the last 20 months.
Yeah.
Basically, but it goes prior to that. It goes up, you know, to ask the question, how did he get elected?
Right.
And it really doesn't go into the Russia stuff that much. For that, I actually recommend a really great documentary called Active Measures that's available online right now. That's a full Russia retrospective.
Mm-hmm.
But this is all about, you know, his tendencies, how the joke of him running for president became a reality. And then the movie, it takes, like, side trips. Like, it actually, there's a section of the movie that actually steers his way back to Flint, Michigan to talk about the water crisis.
Sure, yeah.
And there's very, I mean, other than Trump, you know, the way he connects Trump to being enamored with how Rick Snyder was able to get away with this whole thing, mm-hmm. there's really not a lot of Trump in that section. It's all about Flint. It shifts over to the, you know, the Parkland shootings, and has all of those, you know, all the kids from that that movement in it. So I mean, this movie it kind of rambles at times. It just kind of goes from topic to topic, and then steers itself back to Trump, and then, you know, puts his voice in Hitler's mouth. You know, so typical Moore type
right,
stuff.
Right.
But I do have to say that it is his best film since Sicko. It is rambling. There are a couple moments in the movie that are very Moore-ish that I have to sort of double check the facts and see exactly if he's on point with some of these things or if he's glossing. There are a couple moments where I'm just like, you seem to be glossing over a couple things there to make your point.
Right.
And I always hate it when he does that. But it's a good film. I think Active Measures that's available right now is a more important film. But this is, you know, if you're angry before, you're going to be angry walking out of this as well.
Okay. All right, Eric, hang on, okay? Hold on a second.
Sure.
Eric Childress is with us. That's Fahrenheit 11-9, which will be coming out at the end of this month. It's Michael Moore's new documentary about Trump. So, Eric saw it in Toronto. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got more with Eric in Toronto right here on 720 WGN. And welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. My dad will call in later to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about some great rock and roll pioneers, 11 noises that kids wouldn't recognize or never heard before nowadays. And because the NFL season kicked off, we're going to tell you how all the NFL teams got their names. Plus more. Phone lines are always open. Text lines are always open. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking with Eric Childress right now. He is in he's in Toronto with the Toronto International Film Festival. He's seen a bunch of movies, and he's telling us about the ones that he's seen. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, now you said so that was the first of a political film that you wanted to talk about, which was Fahrenheit 11-9. What was the other one?
The other one is called The Front Runner.
Okay. Is this the one about Gary Hart?
That's correct.
Oh God! All right. No, I'm sorry. The trailer looks ridiculous, and I can't even imagine Hugh Jackman as Gary Hart. I can't even imagine it.
Yeah. Well, there you go. It's Hugh Jackman as Gary Hart in Jason Reitman's new film about the 1988 election season when Gary Hart was the high front runner over George H.W. Bush in the Republican primaries.
Right.
And the movie basically covers this three-week period where the scandal started to break and his lead crushed, and he was eventually out of the race. People who don't remember this period in history, Gary Hart was caught sleeping with a staffer of his named Donna Rice, who was played by Sarah Paxton in the film, by the way.
Yeah, that's the only reason that I want to see it.
Yeah. you don't see the actual affair.
Yeah. But she's in it, and I love her. I love Sarah Paxton.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it charts this whole thing where the movie wants to, seems to take the position that, this is where journalism started to go too far. That it was, there's a lot of talk in the movie about how this stuff wasn't investigated during the John F. Kennedy years and all this kind of stuff. And Alfred Molina plays Ben Bradley in the film. So, this movie is, taking chunks of much better movies, political movies, two in particular. One, obviously, being The Post, which is still fresh in our mind.
Yeah.
And the other one, so obviously that it wants to be, is Primary Color.
Yeah, that's the first thing that popped into my head when I saw the trailer was like, don't try.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I even invoked the name.
Yeah,
frankly, because this movie is garbage.
Yeah,
this movie is really bad. This is a movie that can't figure out what position it wants to take on the entire scandal. It's the kind of movie that is the movie that keeps telling you how great a president Gary Hart's going to be without actually giving you any insight into why we should believe that. It's the kind of movie, you know, where they're interviewing Donna Rice, and twice in the movie she tells you she's magnum cum laude and that she didn't deserve this kind of stuff. And, you know, the press are just sneaking in the backyard and his bushes and stuff like that. And how dare you do, you know, it's that kind of movie. I'm like, well, wait a minute. He got caught during,
yeah.
This is one of the, something that they, you know, they found 20 years ago.
Yeah.
There are clearly a lot of debates to be had about all of this stuff. But this movie isn't interested in having any of them.
You know what's really, hearing this, Eric, what's unbelievably disappointing is that this is his follow-up to Tully.
Yeah.
I mean, and Tully's such a great movie, you know? And, I don't know.
Yeah, this might, you know, Reitman, we might be thinking that this, you know, my Rob Reiner argument, that maybe he needs good scripts.
Yeah.
And Diablo Cody gave him three good scripts.
Right.
And, you know, Up in the Air, you know, I don't think Thank You for Smoking is particularly good. I'm a big fan of Up in the Air. But some of his other movies, not so great.
I'm with you on that rundown entirely. I like Up in the Air. I don't love it. I like it. And the other ones, Thank You for Smoking, I didn't care for. And the other ones are not very good. But the Diablo Cody movies, all three of them are good.
Yeah. And this is a movie that could be very timely. It's a movie that, you know, it has so many angles that it could connect with, you know, with the current administration and all this kind of thing. But it's not interested in having those conversations. It's interested in, you know, Reitman trying to do a Robert Altman-esque type movie. You know, all the characters are talking over one another.
Right, right.
And all the scenes and stuff like that. And, you know, the camera's moving all over the place. And it's just, you sit there just like, but you, there's nothing. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
A terrible film.
Yeah, it looks bad. I have to say, my first impression when I saw the trailer was no. So, all right. Where do you want to go next?
Well, speaking of both rising stars and films that you weren't crazy about the trailer,
mm-hmm.
Let's go to A Star Is Born.
Okay, Bradley Cooper's the fourth version of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fourth version, 1937, 1954, and 1976.
Right.
And, you know, the first question, obviously, is why do we need another version of this story? That's a pretty easy question to ask. You know, Bradley Cooper wanted to take this on as his directorial debut. Kind of interesting. You know, maybe you want to go in with something familiar and, you know, put your own spin on it. And it's Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga in the film. And, you know, people know what the story is. You should by now. And I'll say, you know, it's a movie that's divided into two halves, the rise and the fall, and, you know, the both of them are going in different directions.
Right.
And I will say that the first half of this movie, I think, is pretty terrific.
Yeah.
I think Cooper and Lady Gaga are both very good. Their performances are terrific throughout the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the songs are great in the movie. I think the songs are particularly good. I think the second half, when it starts to get her rise, his downfall a little bit, there are some elements that don't quite compute. They try to do the whole, and I've seen this, we've seen this like two or three times at this festival alone, where the trope about how music producers try to turn great singers into poppy icons,
right,
kind of thing, and how that's somehow a bad thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
considering, you know, how one of your favorite artists of all time is Madonna.
Yeah.
And I know that's kind of your Lady Gaga, you have an issue with that,
right.
obviously.
Right.
But, you know, I think Madonna and Lady Gaga are two examples of how you can have a great poppy influence in your music and not feel like a sellout.
Right.
And you know, and that's one of the things that, you know, is kind of bothers me about for the second half of the movie, which is just, I mean, it's not bad. It's just kind of like, oh, this kind of stuff could have been handled better. But it's a film that's going to be very well liked.
Yeah,
It
seems to me, though, that it seems to be closely aligned with the Barbra Streisand version from 76. It feels like he looks like Kris Kristofferson. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it seems like that they're taking it from the 76 version mostly.
Yeah, and when I first saw the trailer and the sort of the drawl that Bradley Cooper has for his character, I thought he was doing Eddie Vedder throughout the movie, actually. And but actually, his brother in the movie is played by Sam Elliott.
Mm.
And apparently he was developing his voice to be more like Sam Elliott.
Oh, I see.
And the Elliott is terrific in the movie, too. There's a lot of, Dave Chappelle's in the film. A lot of good people in this movie. Elliott is really good in his scene. And it's the movie that a lot of people are going to like.
Yeah.
People who are familiar with the old stories, it's a very old-fashioned story. The Lady Gaga fans, obviously. Bradley Cooper's certainly got his share of fans. It's a crowd-pleasing, sad movie.
Okay. All right.
I think that you're going to see a lot of Oscars for it.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And it's co-written by Eric Roth, which is another interesting screenwriter. And Bradley Cooper co-wrote it as well. So, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. I'll tell you what, the 76 version of A Star is Born is one of my mom's favorite movies of all time. Like, of all time. And every time we see the trailer for this movie, she's like, we have to see it. Like, she's very excited about it.
she will very much like it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right, where do you want to go next?
Well, I guess since I just mentioned Oscars, I want to talk about a movie called Beautiful Boy.
Yeah, this is Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's based on a true story, a memoir, a paramemoir, a couple memoirs, written by a writer for Rolling Stone, who's played by Steve Carell. And his son, Timothy Chalamet, is addicted to a number of different substances, but particularly crystal meth. This is a story about, flat out, it's a story about addiction more than recovery. And, we've seen so many countless movies, broaching the subject, some great ones, some really melodramatic ones. But this one, to me, very few movies capture the sort of the feel, the sort of the helpless feel of addiction, not just by the person who's addicted, but by the people around them who love them and want to try to help them. And that's what this movie has, I think, going for it in spades. Because a lot of the movie is told through the eyes of Steve Carell's character, who's just, he so wants to do everything he can for his son, but he won't let him, in a way.
Yeah.
And he wants to understand the addiction more than trying to cure it. Necessarily.
Yeah.
So, no, it might not be something that can be cured, but maybe it can be controlled, stemmed off, and maybe if I understand it a little bit better, I'll be able to know what direction to take with it.
Right.
And that's what this movie has that feel to it. I actually compared it in a different sort of way, actually, to Requiem for a Dream, because that movie, is a horrific tale of what it's like to be an addict.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, I think, it's kind of like Requiem for a Dream for, the person who's not addicted, to the person that just wants to help.
Right.
And, Carell, I think, is really good in the film. And Chalamet is my God.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of performances where characters are strung out on drugs and things. And this one, there's also that helplessness feel, that you really get to feel that the need for it, in his story, not just that, like, oh, I'm just going to do it because I want to get high, but that there's a need for it, even when he's sober as hell, that there's going to be a moment where it's going to come close to a breakdown. And I like this movie, I think, a lot more than some people did, because I really had that feeling that it was taking the story of addiction in a way that we don't often see in film.
Okay. All right, that's called Beautiful Boy, and it will be in theaters. We'll be able to see it in October 12th.
So. Yeah.
All right, Eric, hang on. We'll come back in another quick set of reviews, okay?
Okay.
All right, Eric Childress is with us. We'll take a quick break here on WGN, and when we come back, a couple more reviews from Toronto, from the Toronto International Film Festival, right after this on WGN. Welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio Monday morning, and we're here every weekday morning, 1 to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich, with opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. We're wrapping things up here with Eric Childress, who every year gives us live reports from the Toronto Film Festival. All right, Eric, where do you want to go next?
Okay. Well, I hate to end this with a couple of disappointments,
okay,
but that's the nature. And one, the next one is actually another story about addiction that I saw just yesterday as well. It's called Ben is Back.
Ben is Back.
And it's a new film from Peter Hedges, who did Pieces of April, wrote What's Eating Gilbert Grape, adapted About a Boy. So it was, this is a very, very good writer. And his son, Lucas Hedges, is the star of this movie. He plays Ben, who comes back home. He's been in recovery for a couple of months, and he comes back home unexpectedly, leaves the treatment on a kind of a pass, and his whole family is surprised and horrified to see him. His mother, played by Julia Roberts, is very happy to see him, but her husband, played by Courtney B. Vance, and her daughter, played by Catherine Newton from Blockers, she's not so happy because there have been some incidents over the last couple of holidays involving his addictions to painkillers and much worse. So there's there's kind of an internal struggle going on about whether or not he's welcome back for this particular Christmas. The first half of the movie is the family coming to terms with that, and I think that's when the film is at its best. Not great. I think Beautiful Boy does a lot of this stuff better. There's a little bit more speechifying and some melodramatic stuff going on in the first half, but it actually gets up to a point where about halfway through the movie, I think it actually reaches an actual climax to the story. I'm just like, well, that's a really nice moment, but we're only halfway through, and the second half of the movie actually turns into this like crime plot involving people from his past that he owes money to that might be now terrorizing his family, and his efforts to put a stop to that, and it leads to basically Julia Roberts chasing him down for the last half of the movie, and that's when the movie just gets completely convoluted, and I couldn't really go along with the story anymore. So the first half of the movie, it was on the right track, and then by the second half, I was just like, "Where are you going with this?" And it just leads to a place, to a lot of places that I thought were very false.
Yeah.
Where again, Beautiful Boy, I thought hit a lot of those truths a lot harder.
Okay. I really loved, as you know, I loved Pieces of April.
That movie.
I adore that movie. So this is kind of disappointing. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, we got time for one more. What do you want to get to next?
Okay. One more is the new film from Joel Edgerton, actor and writer, and he also co-stars in the movie. It's called Boy Erased.
Okay.
And it also stars Lucas Hedges.
Wow.
As that boy,
okay,
in the film, as a gay, closeted gay teenager whose father is Russell Crowe. He's a pastor, and his mother is played by Nicole Kidman. And as the movie opens, he's being placed into a center that specializes in gay conversion therapy.
Well, we already had that. We already had the Chloe Grace Moretz movie.
Yes. Miseducation, yeah. Of Cameron Post.
Right, right.
Yeah. We have. So this is the second gay conversion movie of the year. I really hate it. That's the Cameron Post film for a variety of reasons. It's actually one of the worst films of the year, frankly.
Yeah.
And this film is not much better. I don't know why it's so hard to display the insidiousness of this particular brand of therapy on screen. I don't know if they're afraid to go the full route with this, but this is a movie that, again, is very clumsy. It's very sort of confused about what direction it wants to take. And sometimes I was even confused whether or not it was going in a straightforward line at times, because the movie jumps around with him in college, and then he's home, and then he's in the therapy, and it's but it's voluntary, so the keys are getting driven to it and whatnot. So there's so many things about the movie that could have been handled much better. Joel Edgerton plays the leader of this therapy group,
right?
And he has the weirdest title credit I've seen in some time. You're watching the credits and it says with Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers,
right? Yeah,
with Flea just pops up on the screen. And he plays one of the guys in the cohorts of the therapy group.
Yeah.
He plays the real jerk.
Well, sure.
In that group. Yeah. I can't understand why it's such an easy target. It should be so easy to make people, right thinking people feel something during, a movie like this.
Right.
And I think, Russell Crowe gets to do some good stuff towards the end of the movie. Hedges is fine. I think he's better in Ben is Back, frankly. And I think Nicole Kidman's character is incredibly underwritten. She plays, basically the mom that is confused about the whole situation, but then grows to be the right thinking one in the family.
Right.
And that arc is not very well explored and feels very cliched. I was really looking forward to this because I really wanted to see a movie tackle the subject with some real gravitas, and this one just isn't it.
Okay. That's Boy Erased. It opens November 2nd. All right. Well, Eric, you're there until Thursday, and then we'll get another full report. We'll get another full report a week from this morning.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, man. Have fun.
Thanks a lot.
All right. See you later. There you go. Eric Childress giving us exclusive reviews of movies at the Toronto International Film Festival. All right. Let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN.